This is Cynthia DeFelice, and I will be reading a selection from my book, Bringing Ezra Back, a sequel to the book, Weasel. A bit of background before I begin. Weasel takes place on the Ohio frontier and ends in the spring of 1840. Bringing Ezra Back picks up several months later in the fall of that year. Nathan Fowler, 12 years old now, his sister Molly, 10, and their pa always look forward to the arrival of the peddler, whose pack is filled with wonders and who brings news of the world far from their remote farm in the woods. One day around harvest time, he shows up. But to Nathan's dismay, it is not Isaac, the peddler they know and love, but a new fellow by the name of Orrin Beckwith. In the course of Beckwith's evening at the Fowler's cabin, a broadside advertising a traveling show falls from his pack. The show features human oddities, curiosities, and monstrosities, including a white engine, a man with no name and no tongue. Realizing this white engine can only be their mute friend Ezra, a victim of Weasel's cruelty, Nathan declares his determination to find Ezra and bring him back. Next morning, Pa told me it was settled. I was leaving that very day to go with Orrin Beckwith. Beckwith would take me back along his route into Pennsylvania, where he was sure we'd hear news of the traveling show. It all seemed so sudden-like. The plan, as Pa had just described it, sounded as wiggly as his eyesight. All at once, I had my doubts about it. Pa must have known, because he caught my eye and gave a sideways glance at Molly. Then I knew there was more he wanted to say to me, but not in front of her. I nodded to show I understood. I looked at Orrin Beckwith, who was settling up with Pa over the cost of Molly's dyes, and felt more than a little uncertain at the prospect of heading off with him. Then I thought of Ezra again and pushed the uneasiness out of my mind. Pa caught up with me when I was doing my chores. I'd fed the chickens and Job, our horse, and was milking Golly when Pa came into the barn. I kept my eyes on the stream of milk hitting the pail while we talked. "Nathan," he said, "I'm of two minds about this thing. I want to help Ezra, but not if it means putting you in danger." There was silence for a minute, and I looked at Pa. He was rubbing his eyes with the heels of his hands. His shoulders looked droopy. The worry in his mind showed all over his body. "I can't think what could have happened for Ezra to end up in such a fix," he said. I had been wondering about the same thing. It bothered me, too. But I'd come up with an explanation in my mind. "Here's how I figure it," I said. "I reckon these show folks tricked him somehow, and he couldn't speak up for himself. And since he turned his back on killing and such after he left the army, he wouldn't fight back. That's why he needs help, Pa." Pa looked thoughtful. "Could be you're right. There's just no telling." "I expect finding him will be the hardest part," I said, then shrugged. "After that, I'll bring him home with me." Pa hesitated a minute. "What if he doesn't want to come?" I looked at him, astonished. "Why wouldn't he want to leave that show? You know how he is about being around people." "Yes," Pa said gently. "And that includes us too, Nathan." "But..." "Oh, I know Ezra cares for you and Molly and me," Pa went on. "But he's given up on white folks' ways. You know that." "At least I can get him away from that show and then..." My voice trailed off. I didn't know what would come next. Pa shook his head. "Say he is with the show against his will. Who's holding him? And what's a boy, even one near grown like yourself, going to do about it?" I was quiet, thinking. "I reckon I can't know till I get there," I said finally. Pa looked at me, and in his face I could see how much he wished he could do this instead of me. "I'm not afraid, Pa," I lied. "I am," he said, but his voice was so low I wasn't sure I'd heard right. After a moment, he spoke again. "I remember listening to a preacher one time. He said that when a man is faced with a decision, a hard choice is almost always the right one. But I can't figure out which is harder, turning my back on Ezra's trouble or sending you off after him. I keep wondering what your mama would say about all this. She'd want me to help Ezra, I said without hesitating a minute. You know how she was. Yes, but she'd rather have died herself than see you come to harm, Pa said. My eyes blurred with sudden tears, and I tried to blink them away. Nothing's going to happen to me, Pa. After a moment, I added, though I wish it was Isaac I was going with, instead of Beckwith. Pa looked at me curiously. Beckwith gave me his word he'll stay with you until you find Ezra. He seems a decent fellow. I shrugged. I didn't want Pa to change his mind, so I decided not to say any more. But it was like Pa knew how I was feeling. He sighed and said, Nathan, there's another reason I'm going to allow you to do this, besides Ezra's needing help. What's that? I asked. Ever since that business with Weasel, you've reminded me of a horse I used to have, he said. A horse? I repeated. Which one? I called him Amos, Pa said. Pa named all his horses out of the Bible, but I didn't recollect one by that name. It was before you were born, Pa went on. I don't know what happened to old Amos before I got him, but whatever it was, it made him skittish. I raised my hand just to scratch my nose. He'd buck or shy away. Now, you know I'd never strike an animal, but you couldn't have convinced old Amos of that. Didn't matter how kind and gentle I treated him. Beckwith had as much as called me a pig before, and now Pa was saying I reminded him of a horse. I didn't take to being likened to a creature as foolish as the one Pa was describing. I waited to see just what he was getting at. I reckon what I'm saying is, I don't want to see that happen to you, son. A man who's suspicious of everybody ends up in a mighty sad and narrow place. I was struggling to understand. You said this had something to do with Weasel. Are you saying I'm wrong to be wary of him and his kind? No, Pa said softly. The trouble comes when you can't see the difference between him and his kind and regular, well-meaning folks. I waited for him to go on. That's why I'm thinking it might do you good to go out in the world a bit. Open your eyes to all the different sorts of people out there. I stood quiet, trying to let my thoughts settle. Pa was going to let me go after Ezra. That was good, even though I didn't much hold with his reasoning, especially the part about the horse. Pa reached into his trouser pocket and held something out to me. It was a cloth pouch with a leather drawstring. Take this, he said. If you need it, spend it. I opened the pouch and stared at the $5 gold piece. It hardly seemed real. But Pa, where did it come from? It was your mama's. She was saving it. She always said there'd come a day when we'd have need of it. I reckon she'd want you to have it now. It made me feel safer somehow to have Mama's gift with me, close to my heart. I slipped the pouch over my head and hid it under my shirt so nobody, including Beckwith, would know it was there. I hope not to use it, I said. I'd like for you to get yourself some of those spectacles. Pa smiled. Wouldn't that be something? After a moment, he said, Beckwith's anxious to get on his way, Nathan, so when you're finished here, we'll get you packed up and then... He stopped there. I didn't want to think about saying goodbye till I had to, and I reckon he didn't either. I'll be just a few more minutes, I told him. When I finished milking Golly, I gave her a pat and led her into the fenced-in pasture. Then I brought Job out to join her. I patted Job's velvety nose and buried my face in his mane for a moment. His warm, familiar smell always comforted me. I murmured in Job's ear something about itchy feet and how I was going on a journey and how I'd see him soon, and he whinnied back like he got my meaning. Job was sweet-natured, patient, and hard-working. We were lucky to have him. Weasel had come and stolen him once, along with our mule, Crabapple, and some chickens and piglets. My pet pig, Ms. Tiz, had been too big for Weasel to carry off, but that hadn't saved her from his meanness. When I'd found her lifeless body, I'd known right off it was Weasel who done it. The memory chilled me even now. I'd gotten Job back, but we never did see Crabby again. I still missed him and his stubborn ways. Back at the cabin, Molly took a locket strung on a strip of leather from around her neck and handed it to me. Ezra had made it for her, out of bone, with a likeness of her face carved into it. Then she took a tall black hat from the hook on the wall and placed it on my head. It used to be Ezra's, and I'd told him once how someday I aimed to get me a hat just like it. When he'd gone away in the spring, he'd left Molly the locket, with a snip of his hair inside, and he'd left me the hat, along with a message to be happy wearing it. "Come back soon," Molly said fiercely, "with Ezra."
Hi, Cynthia. Your new novel, Bringing Ezra Back, is the long-anticipated sequel to the popular Weasel. Why did you decide to continue the story?
Well, Weasel was published in 1990, and since then I have been amazed at the number of schools that have made it part of their curriculum, and I've received literally thousands of letters from kids begging for a sequel. And I was thrilled by this because it meant that they cared about Nathan Fowler and Ezra and the other characters enough to wonder what happened to them next. Did Nathan learn to play the fiddle, they asked? Did Pa remarry? Did Ezra find happiness with his dead wife's Shawnee kinfolk? But their love of the first book and their enthusiasm also made me cautious and nervous, too, because I thought better no sequel than a disappointing one. It took 15 years for me to think of a story I thought might be as exciting as the original. And I thought that despite Nathan and Ezra's determination to put Weasel behind them and be happy, that they would nevertheless be forever marked by knowing him. And it was this that I wanted to explore, the legacy left behind by Weasel's evil acts.
And how would you describe Bringing Ezra Back?
I always find it difficult to describe my own books. I want to say, read the book, because, you know, of course, you put in every word you think is important. So I'd rather have people read it than try to reduce it to a few sentences, but it's a fair question. The book, of course, is historical fiction, and it's the story of Nathan's journey through the landscape of Ohio and Pennsylvania in 1840, as well as a continuation of his journey toward understanding his world and the people in it. One thing that was fun in this book was that there were more occasions for humor in this one than in Weasel, and I had great fun with the characters of Orrin Beckwith and the itinerant portrait painter, Joseph Honeywell, as well as all the characters in the so-called freak show.
Cynthia, in your books, you're always exploring human nature, the bad and the good. In Bringing Ezra Back, the characters come through harrowing episodes, but find a measure of peace through the bonds of friendship and love. What draws you to this theme?
Well, it seems to me that our most important job in life is to learn how to proceed in the face of a world where things are seldom black and white. My middle grade readers are struggling every day to find their way through the gray areas that characterize almost every action they take and every decision they make. Nobody escapes. We all have those harrowing episodes and struggles in our lives. When my readers travel through their own dark forests, I guess I hope that some of Nathan's experiences will be helpful to them. In the book Weasel, the character of Weasel himself epitomized pure evil. In this book, Nathan copes with the realization that most people aren't all good or all bad, but a confusing combination of many characteristics. He finds that he needs to develop instincts about people and learn to trust himself.
You are known for historical fiction, but readers notice that you never get bogged down in historical detail, or rather use it to propel the story forward. How do you walk that fine line?
Boy, it is a fine line, and I feel so, so strongly that you can't let your research show. Kids don't want to plod through paragraphs of description, but they love to be transported to another time and place. I guess the most important thing is that when I begin a book of historical fiction,
I have to be able to imagine a young character in that place and time having a rip-roaring good adventure. I read, I interview people, I go to museums and libraries, I visit the places about which I'm writing. And in the course of doing all this, I amass huge piles of information, all of which at that point seems fascinating to me because I'm immersed in this. And then I have to weed out 99 and 99 100% of all that stuff, keeping just the pertinent gems that I think will place my readers squarely in the setting without making them feel like they're reading their social studies book. I constantly remind myself that every historical detail must advance the plot and reveal character at the same time it's serving to ground the story in a real place and time. So research is, to me, it's like the skeleton of the book. Without a solid framework, the book won't stand up. But a satisfying story requires so much more, and I have to put meat on those bones.
With that in mind, can you tell us a little bit more about your research for Bringing Ezra Back?
My research began with discovering what Ezra would have actually found when he went out to the Indian territories in search of his Shawnee wife's kinfolk. And what I found was that the Shawnees experienced something very much like the Cherokee Indians' Trail of Tears. It was not a pretty story, but I knew it had to be part of this book. Secondly, I needed to learn about the itinerant peddlers, the Yankee peddlers, the people who plied their trades in the woods, who survived on the strength of their wits as well as the strength of their backs. And lastly, the spectacle of the traveling freak shows of the time. It's always fascinated me. And this required many hours in libraries and also on the internet as well.
How does your past experience as a storyteller inform your writing, your description of settings, memorable characters, and colorful dialogue?
Well, I really do think telling stories aloud has helped me in my writing. When you tell a story, you quickly find out what works and what doesn't, since your audience is right there before your eyes. Long descriptions and expository passages are much less effective than dialogue and brisk narration. It's important to evoke characters through the things they say and the way they talk. I think my experience reading aloud to kids as a school librarian helped, too. I'm always cognizant of how my books sound, and I think about teachers and parents reading them aloud to children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.